The first tour we did was in France, and that was completely on our own. We met this sketchy promoter that was in Paris, and that was through MySpace way back when. And we got in touch, and he said, "Oh, let's put a tour together." So we thought, "Oh, we'll give it a shot." And we ended up getting something like 8 dates or so in France. And we went over, and the tour was sold out. Every show was sold out, and the demand was amazing. I remember getting out of the airplane and jumping in the taxi, and our music was playing on the radio. And I thought, whoa, what's going on? And everywhere you'd go, you'd hear our music. And I was like, what's happening? This is so strange, because in Canada, no one cared about us at all.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This podcast strives to inspire you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians worldwide, with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. Pierre Chrétien is a Canadian bandleader, multi-instrumentalist, and composer who has had international success with his bands The Soul Jazz Orchestra, Atlantis Jazz Ensemble, and his project Cinephonic. And in this episode, you'll learn about all these and hear highlights from some of these albums on the Marlow Records label. Pierre shares how he left his career as an engineer to devote himself to a full-time career as a performer. He also demonstrates some rare vintage instruments at the beginning of this episode, which he's also an expert at repairing. Pierre is so creative, and some of his gorgeous album covers are linked to the episode notes on my website, which of course links to Marlow Records. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on all the podcast platforms, and I've linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. Did you know that this podcast is in season 4 and that I send out a weekly email newsletter where you can get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests and be inspired by highlights from the archive? Please click on those links in the description as well. Now to the episode. Hi, Pierre. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, Leah.
So you're sitting at your vibraphone.
Yeah.
This is very cool. We haven't had a vibraphonist yet on the series. Do you want to start with a demo?
Sure. I'll stand up. It's just to get the shot, you know?
Yeah. So with the vibraphone, how is it different than a marimba?
So what you have here is two rows of metal bars. A marimba is made out of wood. And underneath each of these bars, I don't know if you can see it in the shot there, but there's these rotating discs that are on top of resonators, so the long tubes here. So that gives the vibrato effect. And you can control the speed of it with there's a little knob here. You can go real slow. And then this is the fastest here. This is an older model from the 1960s, made in England by Premier. The modern ones, you can actually like type in the beats per minute and get it just perfect, but this is just fine too.
Fantastic. Now you're a keyboard player. What motivated you to want to learn the vibraphone at a certain point?
Oh, it's such a beautiful instrument. I just think it's just so dreamy, and it's used mainly in jazz. So you hear vibraphone, it really takes you to a certain place right away. You know, it has that urban jazz sound. And I picked it up, and then at first I was just playing with two mallets, like one in each hand. And then eventually I learned four mallet technique, There's a guy called Gary Burton. He's a jazz legend, and he invented this grip here. Okay. And he gives really nice tutorials on YouTube on how to master this, you know, and the whole motion. So so that came about a little later, and that's it.
Wonderful. Now, I know we're going to be playing tracks from some of your albums and talking a lot about your life and music, but I know you have another very cool instrument there that probably most people have never seen or heard before.
Yeah. What we have here is it's called a Vintage Vibe Electric Piano, and it's actually a modern version of the Fender Rhodes Electric Piano. It was an instrument that was invented during the Second World War by Mr. Harold Rhodes. He wanted to invent a small piano that soldiers could fit on their laps while they were in the hospital so that they could, you know, learn piano and get their minds off of the war. And the first models he built out of airplane parts. And then and they were acoustic. And then eventually he got together with Leo Fender, the guy who invented the Fender Stratocaster and the Fender Telecaster and the Fender Precision Bass. And they amplified it with a series of pickups. Mm-hmm. And the way it works, there's hammers that hit tuning forks. So there's a tuning fork for each note, but they're kind of lopsided tuning forks. So you have, I don't know if you can see here, that these big bars on top, and then there's a smaller tine on the bottom. So it's like a lopsided tuning fork. Mm-hmm. And then there's a pickup at the end of each, the bottom fork, the bottom tine, to amplify the instrument. And on the bottom tine, there's also a spring that you can move forward and backwards, and that tunes the instrument.
Okay.
Did you want to hear a bit?
So when did, definitely, I'm just curious, when did you acquire that particular instrument?
This is a modern version. It's made by a company out of New Jersey called Vintage Vibe. And I got this one custom made for myself, and I drove down to Rockaway, New Jersey back in 2015. Okay. and picked it up myself. Yeah,
let's hear something.
A lot of people know this tune.
The tuning forks, because I would think there'd be more of a delay, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty immediate. Yeah, definitely.
Now, that is not the Mellotron, which is what I was expecting.
Oh, yes. Mellotron, I'll be honest, the Mellotron I used on my the first Cinephonic album, it's a modern version. So it's a digital version, so it's a little less cool, maybe. It's still recordings of the initial tapes that were made in the 60s, but it's maybe a little less exciting. These are real instruments. So I thought it'd be more interesting.
For sure. Well, we're going to get into that Cinephonic album, but since we're talking about the Mellotron, can you describe the original instrument? Because I was fascinated to learn about it.
Oh, yeah. So each key on the Mellotron is actually like pressing play on a cassette player. So it actually plays a tape recording of whatever your instrument you choose. The by default, the cheaper Mellotrons came with flute, violin or cello, and a human voice. But some of the more advanced Mellotrons had dozens and dozens of different sounds. So it was really the first kind of sampling keyboard invented in the 1960s. And you can hear it on songs like Strawberry Fields Forever by the Beatles, or Nights in White Satin by the Moody Blues, songs like that. Or What's Going On, Marvin Gaye. So
the one that you have that's digital, there are digital samples of the original.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
But it still sounds old and, But yeah, it's a little less exciting maybe.
Well, you know, it's interesting because that first Cinephonic album, which is called Les Paradis Artificiels, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when you're listening to it, it sounds very orchestral.
Yeah, well, I initially meant it for orchestra. So I wrote it like an orchestral score with all the different staffs. Mm-hmm. But then COVID hit and it was harder to get in touch with musicians. So I thought, let's give this a shot. So I actually performed each line as if I'm that instrument, you know, so I really try to put myself in the mindset of the flute player or the bassoonist or the French horn player, whatever.
It's a beautiful album. It must have taken so much work to do that.
It was long. Yeah, it's painstaking going track by track and overdubbing everything. But it was interesting. It was a fun experiment to do.
Well, your second album, you did hire a bunch of musicians, Visions. I thought, could we include the track Le Combat?
Of course, yeah.
Do you want to talk to that track or that album?
Yeah, so that whole album, I wanted to do something different. I've always, since I studied composition with Dr. Stephen Gelman, he got me interested in Gregorian chants. He thought my compositions were a little bit, maybe a little stiff or predictable, so he wanted to teach me about different rhythms and different rhythmic structures. So we studied Gregorian chants and ancient Greek rhythms and Hindu rhythms. And you might not think of Gregorian chant as being particularly rhythmic, but the cool thing about it is that it's made up of additive rhythms. So you have short notes and long notes, but no bar lines, no time signatures or anything like that. So it makes for a much more fluid kind of rhythm. So that's when I started getting into Gregorian chant. And this time around, I thought it'd be really interesting doing a modern take on vintage medieval Gregorian chant. Mm-hmm. So it's actually an album of all cover songs, of songs from the Middle Ages. So Le Combat is actually the most recent one. It was written for Louis XIII, I think. It's a modern arrangement of this. It was for a mass.
So Le Combat means the battle for people who don't speak French.
The initial piece in Latin talks about the battle between good and evil, and so I gave it the title Le Combat because it also had the kind of feel of a breakdance b-boy battle. So.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a double entendre.
You are about to hear Le Combat from Cinephonic's album Visions. You'll find the link to Marlowe Records in the description of this episode. We'll be right back. Now, the whole both of these Cinephonic albums do sound like soundtracks from maybe the 1960s.
Right.
They have a certain vibe. Did you grow up loving, like, old film music? Is this one of your things?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, guys like Ennio Morricone and Michel Legrand and François de Roubaix, it was always, it was part of my upbringing. Even François de Roubaix wrote kids' shows that I used to watch. Chapi Chapeau was written by François de Roubaix. And, you know, things like that. So I guess they just get in your mind, right? It's part of your life soundtrack.
Yeah. I'm not familiar with those names. Are they Quebecois composers or from France?
Oh, they're from France, but all those shows played in Quebec also. I forget his name, but even the composer from Passepartout had some nice things too, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. France and French Canada had a lot in common as far as TV and movies went. I got another guy here if you want to see.
All right. Yeah.
This is a Musser Ampli Celeste from the 1960s. Mm-hmm. It's a really rare instrument. And, it's basically an amplified Celeste. You can't see it, but there's bars inside. And, sounds like this. So that's what you're used to hearing on Celeste, but there's also a really nice bottom end to it. And then there's kind of a percussive middle section. I'd show it to you.
Yeah. So when did you pick up that instrument and how did you come across it?
I picked it up at a flea market in Kingston. I think there was an amateur orchestra there and that's what they were using because real Celeste can be quite expensive.
Yeah.
So I guess this was a cheaper option. Nowadays okay. They'd be using synthesizers and, you know, digital keyboards, but I thought it was a pretty cool instrument.
Very much so.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was thinking, Pierre, the first time I heard you live, you were playing on the street with mm-hmm. Mike Asoudry and Zachary, and so it wasn't the whole Atlantis Jazz Quintet because you had a couple people missing. And you had two keyboards or three, like, stacked.
Yeah.
Because you were... do you remember what you would have been using? It was very impressive.
I would have had the Fender Rhodes electric piano here. And mm-hmm. on top, I also use a Hohner clavinet. A clavinet is an amplified clavichord, which is an old keyboard instrument from the Baroque days. If you ever saw one of the original instruments, they're very, very soft. So it was made for intimate chamber music kind of context. But it makes sense to amplify it because it's such a soft instrument. But when you run it through, at first it was meant to play Baroque music. But jazz and funk musicians soon got hold of it and they found out that it can be very guitaristic, especially if you're running through a wah-wah pedal. So it makes for really cool effects, you know.
Now, I'll alert my listeners. I did an episode last year with Kate Dunton, who's California-based jazz and funk keyboard player who also collects vintage keyboards. But she said they're, like, incredibly fussy. It's, like, hard to find people to fix them.
Yeah.
And the prices have really gone up.
Right. I was lucky enough to get a lot of my things back in the 90s when these things weren't so sought after. A lot of people were getting rid of them for not too much money at all, you know?
Yeah.
And, but I had to learn how to fix everything myself. And now I'm one of the go-to guys in town to fix Rhodeses and clavinets. So it just happened by accident, but it makes for a cool side gig, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's go back to your childhood and some musical memories and how you, I know you have a pretty interesting story, if you want to speak to that.
Sure. I'm originally from Sudbury, Ontario. about 6 hours from here. And I moved over to, well, I started taking piano lessons around 5 years old. And I came from a really musical family, especially on my mom's side, just about everyone played piano. And I remember being a kid and everyone would be around the piano playing boogie woogies and blues and jazz jams. And I thought, oh my God, I want to learn how to do that. And I had one particular uncle, his name is Pierre, just like me. And he was a really good jazz pianist, a little bit in an Oscar Peterson kind of mold. And he showed me a few things, taught me the blues scale and, you know, showed me some voicings. And then I was basically on my own after that. So I taught myself how to improvise and, you know, got into jazz from there. And then eventually in 1997, I moved to Ottawa to study engineering at the University of Ottawa. So I was in computer engineering for a good while. I graduated, I guess, 2003. And worked in high tech for a little bit, and then I found out it wasn't for me. And things were starting to pick up with the Soul Jazz Orchestra, which got started in the meantime. And then that's when I really decided, this is what I want to do with my life. So I quit everything, started over, went back to school, and I ended up getting my master's in theory and composition at the University of Ottawa, studying with Dr. Stephen Gelman and Dr. John Armstrong. So,
I'm curious, did you consider doing like a jazz program somewhere else?
I guess I consider myself a musician. I don't like this guy's a jazz musician, this guy's a mm-hmm. classical musician. I like it all and I do it all. And, you know, and I played in pop bands, I played in all sorts of things. And I've written, you know, symphonies and chamber music. So, I felt learning just taking a jazz program might be a bit limiting. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I've heard great things about Stephen Gelman, and they weren't wrong. He's a phenomenal composer and a phenomenal teacher, and I regret nothing. I'm glad I took that direction. Yeah.
No, I was just curious about that. Mm-hmm. And excuse my ignorance. So computer engineering, is that like the hardware side?
Yeah. I started out on the hardware side, and then halfway through, I moved to the software side. I decided software engineering after that. And, I worked for Nortel. I worked for different high-tech companies in town. Yep.
But that kind of problem-solving training must help you with fixing old instruments.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, and, sometimes you have to do soldering on these things. And, it must come in handy somehow. Mm-hmm. Sometimes just learning to learn helps, you know.
So you mentioned the Soul Jazz Orchestra. Mm-hmm. You had many fantastic albums people can check out. And you toured quite a bit, right? Like, mm-hmm. especially in Europe?
Yeah, we've done about 20 tours, mainly in Europe, but also in the US. We've been to mm-hmm. Africa. We've been to Latin America. So we've done quite a bit of traveling, yeah.
To go to those different places, did you have agents helping you with connections in different countries? How did that work?
The first tour we did was in France, and that was completely on our own. We met this sketchy promoter that was in Paris, and that was through MySpace way back when. And we got in touch, and he said, let's put a tour together. So we thought, we'll give it a shot. And we ended up getting something like 8 dates or so in France, and we went over and the tour was sold out. Every show was sold out and the demand was amazing. I remember getting out of the airplane and jumping in the taxi and our music was playing on the radio, and I thought, whoa, what's going on? And everywhere you'd go, you'd hear our music, and I was like, what's happening? This is so strange, because in Canada no one cared about us mm-hmm. at all. So I thought that was really strange. Once we finished that tour, because it was all sold out and it went so well, it got the attention of a big agent with the agency group. And then we had a proper agent to help us book these tours. But I was still responsible for tour managing, so booking all the hotels and planes, trains, metro, the whole shebang.
So it's a pretty big band. How many members were touring?
We're 6 people. So
okay,
not too bad.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't counted it up in the photos with all the, I don't know, Barry Sachs and big instruments. It looks
impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. You have so many great albums out, and you've designed a lot of those album covers, haven't you, Pierre?
Yeah. I'm also a graphic designer and visual artist. At first I'd let other people do it, but I don't know. I wasn't always satisfied, so I thought, oh, I'll give this a shot. So, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, so I kind of got into it. I enjoyed art as a kid, but I never thought as an adult I would pick it up again. So, it's been interesting.
Did you get any training for graphic design, or you just did it on your own?
A little bit through software engineering, maybe, you know, along the years. But no, I'm mainly self-taught. I like the human touch also. I don't like using the computer too much. So whenever I can, I try to, I use India ink to draw a lot of things, just to give it a more organic feel rather than just using shapes on a computer.
Such a talented guy. Well, of soul jazz, I mean, do you want to share a track from one of your albums?
The big hit was Mr. President back in 2006. That's what kind of launched her career. I played that one to death, so I've kind of heard it enough. There's one tune, Kingdom Come, I really like. It features this vibraphone here. It was from an all-acoustic album. At first we were known for doing Afrobeat and very, you know, heavy dance music, but I thought it'd be really interesting to do dance music, but with only acoustic instruments. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, double bass and vibraphones and trumpets and trombones and, you know, that kind of thing.
You're about to hear Kingdom Come from the Soul Jazz Orchestra album Inner Fire.
Thank you. And I play harp on it as well.
I was going to ask you about harp because I've heard you on some of your tracks playing harp. So it's really an actual harp that you own.
An actual orchestral harp, yeah. On Rising Sun, I played a pedal harp, the really expensive orchestral ones. And on Inner Fire, I played just a lever harp. They're a little less expensive. But you have to make sure there aren't too many accidentals because that could get tricky with the levers, you know.
Did you rent the harps?
I did.
Okay.
There's a great lady in town that... Vixen Harps. She rents out. She has a wonderful collection.
Okay.
So I had to teach myself quick how to play harp. But I managed. It's such a beautiful instrument.
Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media, and share my posts. And if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing, and you can find that link in the show notes. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now back to the episode. If we could talk about the Atlantis Jazz Ensemble, last mm-hmm. year you put out Celestial Suite, just phenomenal album. It's been getting lots of attention. I was hoping we could play the track Joyful Noise.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Do you want to speak to that, the concept of the album and the group?
Yeah, so the group got started around 2013, I think. Zachary France from the Soul Jazz Orchestra, he had a residency at Le Petit Chicago, which doesn't exist anymore. But he wanted to put together a group, so he asked me to join, and we had Mike Isudry on drums, and at the time we had a different bass player and a different trumpet player, I think. But anyway, so that's how it started out, and eventually Alex Bilodeau joined, and Ed Lister. Pretty soon I started writing for the group. We're doing covers, but I always find it's more interesting to do your own compositions. And I felt the group lends itself really well to spiritual jazz music. So music that's kind of conducive to spirituality. And a lot of songs, therefore, have more of a kind of mantra feel, a bit of a repetitive feel. And inspired by guys like John Coltrane or McCoy Tyner, Pharoah Sanders. And we came out with a first album in 2016, Oceanic Suite, and it did really well. It was the number two song on the jazz charts that year, number two album on the jazz charts. Mm-hmm. And then, unfortunately, we lost our bass player. Alex Bilodeau ended up moving to Boston, and he was studying with guys like Dave Holland and Cecil McBee, big stars in the jazz world. And so we took a little break for a while. But then we hooked up with Chris Pond, who's a really good young double bass player. And we got the group started again in, I guess it was 2022. And we had a residency on Somerset Street. You know, with the pandemic, we were doing more outdoor concerts for a while. So we were playing on Somerset Street and decided to write new tunes and get new material going again. And the residency allowed us to connect as a group and solidify the songs. And then in the fall of 2022, we ended up going in the studio, and over 2 days we recorded the album just live off the floor.
Now you're going to hear Joyful Noise from Celestial Suite by Atlantis Jazz Ensemble. Just a quick break from the episode to point out that I recorded a wonderful episode with the drummer Mike Asudri, who's the drummer for Atlantis Jazz Ensemble. And if you missed that one, you should really check it out. I'll be linking Mike Asudri's episode directly to this one in the show notes. Now back to the episode.
I was able to hear you guys two or maybe three times, I think, that summer. And it was really magical, just outside and, just like between different restaurants that had patios. And that's the kind of thing, like, now that things are sort of more, quote, normal, some of those opportunities have gone away.
Yeah.
You know, more streets were closed off. It was kind of special.
Yeah. And I kind of liked how the sound kind of bounced off the buildings. It gave it a really cool vibe. Yeah. It was fun.
That was your son, right? Running around?
Yes. Oh, yeah. He loved those. He loved going to the concerts. Yeah, I had my son running around the whole time, and he'd have his monkey in a little stroller, and he'd run around with his monkey.
Well, so for both of those albums, you call them suites. Like, do you want to talk about the concept in terms of that?
Well, I guess I felt I would write the album, and then I felt that it had a kind of connection. So so it made sense to call it a suite of sorts. The first album was called Oceanic Suite, and I guess I was listening to a lot of Impressionist music, Debussy, La Mer, things like that. I guess that's what I had in my mind. The songs all had this kind of fluidity to it, and I was also experimenting with different pulse layers. So you'll have, like, you know, eighth notes and then dotted eighths and triplets all superimposed. So it feels like different waves in the ocean. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of thing I had in mind with that one. And then this new album, all the songs had a theme of either the sky or spirituality. So Celestial Suite felt like an appropriate name for it. And I like tying things together. Having an album be a whole rather than just different disparate tracks stuck together, you know?
So having such a successful band as the Soul Jazz Orchestra, has that helped you with connections in terms of getting your albums out there?
Yes and no. The audience for Atlantis Jazz Ensemble is a little bit different, maybe. Mm-hmm. With Soul Jazz Orchestra, what I found after a while is that there was such an expectancy of making people dance and groove and party that it was hard to do anything else but party music. And, I was kind of itching to do other things too. And I would try with Soul Jazz sometimes to stretch it out. But, you know, when it's 2 a.m. and you're playing after a DJ and everyone's ready to go, well, it's hard to do introspective ballads and things like that. You could get things thrown at you on stage. So that's what made me want to develop Atlantis Jazz Ensemble. But for sure, there's still overlap, and it did help, you know, all the connections we made over the last 20 years definitely helped promote Atlantis Jazz Ensemble as well. Just to let you know a little bit about Blue Nile, the bass line for that came during an improvisation during a Soul Jazz Orchestra concert, actually, and over an Ethiopian jazz tune. And I kind of remembered it, and it triggered me to write the song Blue Nile. So it's based on the Tezeta minor mode, which is one of the Ethiopian modes, and the Blue Nile is a river in Ethiopia, so that's where the title comes from.
Now you're going to hear Blue Nile from Oceanic Suite by Atlantis Jazz Ensemble.
very, very cool. I love Ethiopian food, and I just, so I've mostly heard Ethiopian music in the restaurants.
Oh, right.
So when I heard that tune, it was just like brought me back.
That's great.
Eating injera. Okay, thanks for that.
Thank you.
Now, with Marlow Records, is that like, it's your record label?
That's right.
And do you actually record on analog still?
Yeah, we actually have a kind of hybrid thing going. So we will use computers for editing and things like that, but all the tracks are still bounced to tape to get that sound. I find it just compresses things in a really nice way, and it just warms up every instrument. So yeah, it's kind of both.
If you could explain technically, I don't understand how it would compress it on a tape as opposed to...
When you record, there's the record head, it can't react as fast as a computer can. So it tries to do the wave, but it's not quite as accurate. So it's a little lower and a little lower. So the waveform is actually compressed that way. So it just warms up the sound. All the transients that hurt your ears are just kind of softened up. If you listen to a vinyl record or a cassette tape, you'll notice things don't hurt your ears as much as a really sharp digital recording on a computer, you know?
Okay.
It's that kind of thing.
That's interesting. Well, for one thing, I was curious. I mean, are you distantly related to our former prime minister with the name
I don't know. I don't think so. Well, all Kate's hands are probably connected somehow, but no, I don't think so.
How about your process of writing? I mean, you came from this on the paper tradition, mm-hmm. and then you do a lot by ear.
All Atlantis, all soul jazz, all cinephonic stuff is still written on paper. So if you see us on stage, you'll see the sheet music's there for everyone else. I try to memorize things because I don't always like reading on stage. But at the same time, I find a good jazz composer, it's not about how many black dots you put on a page. You're also writing a blueprint for an improvisation. So I think it's important not to be too prescriptive and leave space and not make it so complex that it impedes the creativity of the musicians. So it's a fine line. You want to write things that are interesting enough that it stimulates the musicians, but not so complex that it stops their creativity. Everything's still written on sheet music, though.
But do you use a computer, like a Finale or something, or you're writing?
Yeah, in the early days, I used to write everything by hand and not make photocopies or anything. And then the musicians would lose their charts, and then I'd be like, and then I couldn't remember the piece. And then there's that pieces that actually disappeared because of that. So now I use Finale. Yeah, it's a lot better. You can just print out another copy.
But in your cinephonic albums, mm-hmm. I mean, it's all arranged. It's not so much improv. Are there arrangers that really influenced you in terms of the style?
Oh, definitely. Well, I mean, there's classical musicians. I love Debussy, Ravel, Stravinsky, mm-hmm. Bartok. And then from the jazz world, there's Gil Evans and Duke Ellington. And from the cinema world, there's Ennio Morricone, François de Roubaix, and Michel Legrand. Those are probably the main ones, I'd say.
What do you think about, in terms of the way the business has changed now with streaming and publicity is mostly on social media? Like, you've lived through a lot in the last 20 years. What are your perspectives on that?
Yeah, it's funny. When we started out, there was no YouTube. There was none of that. And everything was still CDs. And we were making a lot more money back then. Yes, it's been difficult. It's really getting hard. Platforms like Spotify, they don't pay a lot. And I saw a documentary on it the other day. It showed why things were like that. It's when Spotify went public, the big major labels, Universal and all those, they owned shares in Spotify. So they negotiated to give musicians as low a cut as possible so that the shares would be as high as possible so that they could maximize their profits and minimize the pay to musicians. Mm-hmm. So that's why. And the rest of the people that weren't on these major labels had zero say. So that's why we're stuck with the situation we're in now. And it's really, it's frustrating. Thankfully, my projects, I don't know why, but they seem to do really well on physical media. The vinyl is selling really well. CDs are selling really well. My last Atlantis album, the vinyl, I got 500 pressed. They sold out within a few weeks. So I had to get another 500 repressed, and that's running out also. So that's keeping me going. Thank God the vinyl's still around and CDs are still selling a little bit. So, but it's tricky.
Yeah, I mean, I bought your digital albums on Bandcamp, so that's great. Are doing well over there. Like, people, would you rather people... see, my problem, I know if I buy directly from an artist off their website, they make a little bit more than Bandcamp, but then I have to put the music, you know what I mean? It's like I have to organize it differently. But
Bandcamp's great. I love Bandcamp. They really take, what they take is so minimal. And compared to the Spotify's and YouTube's and all those, it doesn't compare. So no, I love Bandcamp. And they actually, they take care of a lot of things like the taxes and all the deductions that need to be taken out. Mm-hmm. So no, I always route people to Bandcamp.
Yeah. So how about your lifestyle as a musician? If you look back, like you were going to be a computer engineer and then you made this huge switch and you know, now you're a dad, like how do you think it affects your life to your working life? You know?
Well, it was a big plunge to take, you know, my parents weren't very happy when I told them that I'm not going to be an engineer. And all that schooling was for nothing. And all of a sudden I'm starting over and I'm going to be a musician. And musician, people have ideas. I guess you say musician, people think either megastar or a bum. And they don't realize that for a lot of people, there's an in-between. You know, there's a middle-class musician that, you know, I'm not rich, but I'm doing fine, you know. So... yeah, it was a big plunge to take. But, you know, if you work hard and you apply yourself, I think it's possible to make a decent living.
In terms of the hours, is it hard for you to, like, unwind after gigs? Like, how do you manage that with being a dad and stuff?
There's a lot of hours. And I mean, you're working from home, right? You're self-employed. And it, like, never stops. You know, it's from the morning. And at night when I'm watching TV with my wife while I'm making... the boxes for all the orders that came in during the day. So I'll have my stack of boxes and, you know, put that away. So from morning until the time I go to bed, I'm doing something work related, you know. So it is a lot of work.
Do you have a way of managing the constant emails? And do you sort of apportion time so it doesn't sort of suck your energy?
I try to reserve time every morning for creative work before I open up the email and all that. I work best like first thing in the morning when I have my coffee. I find that's when I'm at my most creative. Mm-hmm. Even when I wake up in the morning, you know, when you just get coming out of your dreams, mm-hmm. I find that, I don't know, as a composer, I find I get a lot of my ideas at that time for some reason.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I'll run to the piano and jot things down. So I try to reserve that time every morning and then I'll open up my email and get going after that. And usually I go to the post office every day, so there's time for that. And,
Are you writing new music? Do you have new projects in the pipeline?
Yeah, I'm always writing new music. You know, it's funny, in the last 25 years, I've produced around, I don't know, almost 20 albums, but they've always been quintets or bigger, and they've all have horns almost, and it's always been big things. And this next one, I'd like to try something like a trio album, mm-hmm. just piano, bass, drums, maybe quartet, maybe vibraphone here and there, but something small and intimate and softer. So I don't know. I think it'd be an interesting challenge.
You mentioned you'd done some writing in, like, I don't even know what to call it, classical music, like orchestral and stuff. Mm-hmm. Where has that stuff been played, or is that more when you were a student?
It was when I was a student and a little bit after as well. Mm-hmm. It was for my master's thesis. It was a It's a symphonic poem. It's called Tezeta, and it mixes Eastern African folk music with jazz and with orchestral classical music. As you'll hear like a little bit of Stravinsky and Debussy in there. And it was performed by the Ottawa Symphony Orchestra in 2010, alongside works by Shostakovich and Bartok. And it's a pretty involved work. It took 2 years of work to get that going. And classical world's tough, though. I'd say it's especially tough for young composers because, people want to hear the hits. They want Mozart and Beethoven, and there's not a lot of room for young French-Canadian composers out there. And I find a lot of new composers tend to write in a kind of samey style. There's a lot of tone clusters and, that style.
Yeah, I think it's changing now, but I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, for a while there's just such a sameness to a lot of new works. And I felt I didn't always fit in with that. Mm-hmm. I use atonality and I use, 12-tone rows sometimes, but I vary it up and, there's some sections that'll be just pentatonic or very tonal and then very chaotic. And I like variety, I like color. And I find just writing tone clusters all the time just gets to be a bit too samey for me.
Yes.
So I thought the whole classical world was difficult to it's hard to make a living doing just that, unless you teach or something else.
Yeah, I was curious, are you teaching at all?
Nope. Just a full-time musician.
Yeah.
And that's fine by me.
Did it ever come up when you were younger that people asked for piano lessons or?
Yeah, I have given private lessons a little bit, but my preference is just to focus on my own music. Yeah.
Yeah. And with your son, are you going to teach him at all or?
He is taking piano lessons right now. And I do supplement his lessons with my own little lessons. I'm teaching him jazz and improvisation and all that.
Okay, you know. That's cool. Just to close out, it might be interesting to reflect on your teen years because you didn't really talk because you were doing classical piano and RCM exams. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing, you mentioned you had your uncle, Pierre, who was showing mm-hmm. you stuff. So was there an element of burnout in terms of that classical path at that time?
Yeah, so I took classical piano until grade 10 Royal Conservatory. That's when I was in grade 8 at school. And I just wasn't very interested at that point. It's the rebellious teen years, and playing classical piano didn't excite me as much. And, and I was listening to jazz and hip-hop and soul and funk. And I wasn't really encouraged to get into that at all. Eventually, I came back to it. In high school, I started taking alto saxophone, took clarinet for a while. I took up guitar. I took pipe organ for a while also. So I was having fun just diversifying and learning new things. And eventually, in university, I got back to it very seriously. But had I had more options to learn maybe jazz or improvisation or maybe things that interested me more, I think I would have stuck it out. But the way the program was structured, I just wasn't interested anymore.
Yeah. I have a feeling that I think it's too much, too little emphasis on people's personal creativity, whether that's composition or improvisation or, just choosing their own repertoire, looking for different kinds of pieces to play.
Yeah, just regurgitating Mozart sonatas was just, it was killing me.
When you started the Soul Jazz Orchestra, you were collaborating with a lot of African musicians here in Ottawa?
Well, a lot, a few, but it had a big impact.
Yeah.
Played with guys like Mighty Popo, Elijah Mbaye, Beautiful Nubia, and also a Malagasy group. And at the same time, on my own, I was getting interested in African music. Mm-hmm. At first, through just more Afrocentric jazz, guys like Herbie Hancock or Pharoah Sanders, and then through actual African musicians like Fela Kuti Mulatu Estatke, and there's a whole bunch. And I just love the polyrhythms, and I studied it a little bit more. I found a book around that time too. It was written by A.M. Jones. It's called Studies in African Music. Mm-hmm. It was the first important book of transcriptions of African rhythms. Came out in the 1950s, and it inspired a lot of musicians. So they have it at the Ottawa U Library. So I took that out, and that helped a little bit too. So and it's stuck with me ever since. It's always kind of a part of my vocabulary now.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for this today. Really interesting.
Hey, thanks for having me. And good luck with the series.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support the series, that would be wonderful. The link is in the description. Have a wonderful week.